Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Len Berman. He's the director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint project of the Urban and Brookings Institutes. Len co-founded the center in 2002. He's also the Paul Volcker Professor at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. Len's here with me today to discuss tax policy and politics under the Trump administration. Len, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Grant.
Now, based on what you saw during the campaign and what you've seen so far from the presidential transition and also in Congress, do you expect that we'll see significant tax cuts passed in the first few months of the Trump administration?
We'll definitely see tax cuts. The nature of the cuts and the exact timing are not entirely clear. And the first thing that'll happen is they'll repeal the taxes that are associated with the Affordable Care Act. And I think the Republicans are prepared to do that on just a straight party line vote, which they can do using the budget rules. The next thing is they've talked about doing tax reform, which is a challenge. And if they try to do fundamental tax reform, that could take a while. But I think there will be a lot of pressure within the GOP caucus to certainly cut taxes. And I think bet money that they would end up with a significant tax cut at some point.
Now, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act and taxes associated with that. There are different kinds of taxes associated with that. So could you break out what you expect in particular will be cut there?
You're asking me to remember all of the taxes that were in the Affordable Care Act. There's a penalty for individuals who don't have health insurance. That's likely to go right away.
Okay.
There are some taxes on medical equipment, manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies and various excise taxes that are likely to be eliminated. Most of these are things that are not pocketbook issues for most individuals, but they add up to a fair amount of money. I think the total cost is like $1 trillion over 10 years.
Okay, and you mentioned both tax reform and simply cutting taxes, and the latter I think is politically easier than the former. So let's just think about the cutting taxes piece of this, which you anticipate will come quicker than some more overall structuring. If we think about the likely tax cuts, who are the kind of folks that are going to most benefit from what you would expect to see, and what particular groups, if any, would be harmed by them?
So the tax cuts that have been put forward by Mr. Trump and by the leaders in the House of Representatives would mostly benefit very high-income people, although there are tax cuts almost across the board. I think there were actually some oversights in the Trump plan that would have caused some single parents to end up paying significantly more taxes in the short term. My guess is that the political system is such that they would correct that before they actually enacted the tax changes. Trump's plan actually would have cut taxes overall by $6 trillion over the next decade, which I don't think is politically feasible, even within the Republican caucus. I think tax cuts of that magnitude would cause concerns about the effects on the debt and ultimately on hurting the economy over the long run. The House Republican plan would have cut taxes by about $3 trillion over the next decade. And the Republican leaders have said that their goal is to have a plan that doesn't increase the deficit after accounting for the effects of macroeconomic feedback, which means that they would have to significantly scale back the tax cuts, because even after accounting for positive growth effects in the short term, their plan would still add $3 trillion to the debt over the next decade. Based on their blueprints, you'd think that the tax cuts would mostly benefit high-income people, and the advocates would say, well, that's appropriate because high-income people are the ones who pay most of the taxes. One question is whether they're going to try to get any Democratic votes to go along with their plans or just pass it on a straight party line vote. The the way they could do it with just Republican votes is by using a budget process called reconciliation. It was actually intended to help control deficits, but they can use reconciliation as a way to pass a big tax cut. That's what happened in the beginning of the Bush administration. Mm. But if they do that, the tax cuts will basically expire at the end of 10 years unless they engage in some serious gimmickry, because there's a rule that says they can't raise deficits outside of the 10-year budget window. The other thing is that they actually might want to get some bipartisan buy-in so that they could claim they have more of a mandate for these changes. But if they do that, there would certainly need to be more in the way of tax relief for low-income people.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about what kinds of things might need to be added to pick up some Democratic support. What particular policy levers would they need to be moving there?
There are a lot of possibilities. One thing that has bipartisan support is the idea of providing more in the way of subsidies for low-income individuals without children who work. There's an earned income tax credit now, which is a significant subsidy for low-income parents, single parents, or some married couples with children. They can get over $5,000 in tax credits if they work enough. But there's an EITC for single individuals without kids, but it's really tiny and it caps out at a very, very low level of earnings. Paul Ryan and President Obama have talked about expanding that pretty significantly. And the argument for doing it is that you want to encourage low-income individuals to get in the workforce and stay in the workforce, both because it will help them in the long run because they develop valuable human capital, they develop skills that will help them to earn more money over time and be more self-sufficient. And also because even though these people don't have children living at home with them, a lot of them are parents. And if they have earnings, if they have enough earnings that they can actually support themselves, it's more likely that they can make child support payments, which also makes it more likely that they'd stay engaged with their children, which is good for the kids, not to mention the single mothers who are trying to make ends meet with relatively low income. Other things that might be done, Marco Rubio and Senator Lee of Utah have talked about a significantly expanded child credit. And the idea is to provide more help for low and middle income families with children. And that might be something that would be on the table as well. There are also a number of expiring provisions that the Democrats like more than the Republicans. For example, a number of energy tax incentives expired at the end of 2016. And it might be that as part of a bipartisan deal that tax credits for solar power and things like that could be extended.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Len Berman, director of the Tax Policy Center at the Urban and Brookings Institutes. Len, you mentioned the deficit and the debt in talking about the impact of different sizes of tax cuts. And we are hearing discussions again about tax cuts stimulating enough additional economic growth to essentially pay for themselves in terms of tax revenue. So could you talk a little bit more about whether that's likely or possible, or at what level of tax cut that becomes likely or possible?
It's certainly not likely, or I would argue even possible, in the context of the proposals that are currently on the table, just because the deficit effects are so large. We have macroeconomic models that we use to examine the effects of tax changes on the economy, which are similar to the ones that the official scores that Congress relies on would be using. And what we expect would happen if you enacted, for example, the Trump tax cut, is that in the short run, it would boost the economy. It would do that for two different reasons. One is because there'd be a big tax cut and people would have more after-tax income and they would have more money to spend. And that would help to increase demand for goods and services, and companies would have to hire and they'd have an incentive to invest more. Over the medium term, just lowering tax rates increases the incentives for individuals to save or to work more. It increases incentives for businesses to invest. And in our models, we assume that there would be more investment over the next 5 or 6 years. By the end of the 10-year budget period, what happens, though, is that the rising debt starts to push up interest rates. And the reason it does that is because the government will be borrowing enormous amounts of money. And ultimately, just because of supply and demand, the price of money would go up. That means interest rates would go up. That would exacerbate the government's deficit problems because they'd be paying higher interest on their government bonds. It also makes things harder for businesses or for individuals that want to borrow. And ultimately, the higher interest rates more than offset the effect of lower tax rates. And by our analysis, and I think the Joint Committee on Taxation would reach a similar conclusion, that over the second 10 years, the economy would actually be weaker. GDP would be lower than it would be if the tax cuts had not been enacted. So the bottom line is that if you had a tax cut that was designed to encourage investment and was close to paying for itself, in other words, had deficits of, you know, a few $100 billion over the decade before accounting for the macro effects, it's plausible that increased saving and working and investment would produce enough additional economic activity and enough additional tax revenues that the plan would be close to balance. But with a plan that adds $3 or $6 trillion of deficits over the next decade, that's just not plausible.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Len Berman, the director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture of the Urban and Brookings Institutes. He's also the Paul Volcker Professor at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. Well, Len, one offset to the tax cuts in order to try to help, I guess, pay for them in a way that has been floated is the elimination of the federal IRS deduction against income for state and local taxes, including property taxes, for those who itemize their deductions on their tax return. And this has been proposed before. I remember it back during the tax reform discussion in Reagan's second term, for instance. So the question is, how likely do you think it is that there will be some kind of substantial change in that particular deduction?
If this is a Republican tax bill, I think this is probably the biggest deduction that could be cut. And the reason is that a lot of the Republicans see the state and local tax deduction as a blue state tax subsidy. Mm-hmm. The states that get the biggest benefit are New York, California, Massachusetts, relatively liberal places with high income residents and pretty expansive state governments. If it's a bipartisan bill, I think it's much less likely. And the reason is that there are a lot of powerful legislators who hate the idea of repealing the state and local tax deduction. I was on a panel once with a number of economists who were talking about the alternative minimum tax, which is an extremely complicated additional tax that some people pay and which most economists don't think is a good idea. And Charlie Rangel at the time was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And he asked all of these people from across the political spectrum how they would pay for repealing the alternative minimum tax. And everyone on the panel said they would repeal the state and local tax deduction. Mm-hmm. Charlie Rangel from Harlem, a high state tax and a high tax state and a high tax city, was really unenthusiastic about that idea, and he moved on pretty quickly. And it is actually true that there are a number of Republican legislators in the House that are in high tax states like New York and California. So it's not a foregone conclusion that the state and local tax deduction would be eliminated. It did not make the cut in 1986, although they did at the time repeal the deduction for sales taxes, and it might not this time.
Now, again, there are a lot of moving parts to thinking about how all these things will play out. But how do you see, again, assuming that there are some kind of significant cuts that are passed. How do you see the impact that would have on discussions about fundamentally rethinking and possibly restructuring two of our most enduring social insurance institutions, that is Medicare and Social Security? What would be the interrelationship there?
Well, one way that policymakers could offset the revenue loss from the tax cuts is that they could make significant cuts in spending. And there has been discussion among Republicans about radically reforming Medicare and Medicaid, and occasional discussions about reforming Social Security as well. So they could use the spending savings from those entitlement programs to offset the revenue loss from the tax cuts. Politically, those have always thought to be the people have thought that those were politically impossible, and I think any significant cuts to Social Security would still be a challenge. But it's certainly true that Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House, and a lot of Republican leaders have been thinking about ways to cut spending on Medicare and Medicaid, and it's a source of a lot of budget savings because it is the fastest growing. They are the fastest growing programs in the budget, both because of rising healthcare costs and because of the aging of the baby boomers who are increasingly getting their healthcare and long-term care paid by those programs. The problem, of course, is designing that in a way that is politically acceptable. And, economists can come up with lots of ideas for cutting unnecessary or health spending that isn't worth the cost, but explaining to someone that they're going to die because Medicare has decided that the cost-benefit calculus isn't right for the therapy that might save their life is a hard sell. So I wouldn't, I should have said this right at the outset, that my crystal ball broke in November. I have no idea what's going on or what's coming in the future, but there are a lot of, as you noted, there are a lot of things that are up in the air, and I wouldn't make any bets as to what Medicare or Medicaid and Social Security will look like 2 or 4 years from now.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is tax policy expert Len Berman. I've got a more specifically political question for you. I want to check something with you and then ask you some questions about it if I'm right. I'm thinking back on recent decades, and I can think of instances where candidates or office holders have paid a political price for proposing an increase in taxes, Walter Mondale, for instance, or for actually increasing taxes, George H.W. Bush, for instance. But I can't think of an instance where candidates or office holders have paid a political price for proposing or implementing tax cuts, even when they seem to increase deficits in the debt, like you've been explaining here earlier in the conversation. So, first of all, is that basic political observation right?
I think that's probably the way most politicians see the situation. You'd think that if people cared about deficits, Al Gore would have been swept into office based on the success of the Clinton administration at turning deficits into surpluses for the first time in 60 years. The one example I can think of is in the early 1980s, Ronald Reagan ran for office promising really big tax cuts, and he delivered. He actually managed to get a bunch of Southern Democrats to join Republicans in Congress to pass what at the time were huge tax cuts. And interest rates went up into unprecedented terrain after those tax cuts. And people on Wall Street, a lot of good, solid Republicans, were coming to President Reagan and saying, these high interest rates are killing us. You need to do something about the deficit. And people don't remember, but Ronald Reagan actually pushed through several significant tax increases and spending cuts in the early 1980s. So he passed the biggest tax cut in peacetime history. He also passed the biggest tax increase in peacetime history not too long afterwards. So ultimately, he didn't completely negate the 1981 cuts, but he scaled them back. And I think that was because of a perception of political pressure. So one question is whether people will see that rising deficits are actually hurting the economy. Right now, with interest rates very low, there doesn't seem to be much of a cost, but that could change.
And we just have a couple minutes left, but kind of a follow-up to that. It also seems that Donald Trump's call for tax cuts did contribute to his victory. I think a lot of people's crystal balls were broken, but that seems to be a piece of the explanation. And so the question is, for the fiscal health of the country, is this kind of political dynamic of the way the interest in and the concern about deficits and debt works relative to the desire to have more tax cuts, is that a political dynamic that we somehow have to change? And how could we change it?
I think it is a dynamic that has to change. Basically, the politicians are choosing between cutting spending, which even Republicans don't like when the spending programs benefit them, and cutting tax and raising taxes, which even Democrats don't especially like when the tax increases fall on them, or running deficits, which basically means kicking the can down the road and saying that our children or our grandchildren will deal with the costs of these programs right now. One thing that's actually concerning about having very low interest rates and what seems to be a glut of capital in the world, meaning that we can borrow lots and lots of money without much of an effect on markets, is that it could enable really, really big increases in the public debt. And somewhere down the road, when we've exhausted, the extra supplies of capital that are available, or Europe or Asia become more attractive places for people to invest, interest rates could go up, and they could go up pretty quickly. And that's a scenario that keeps me awake at night, because then we have this giant debt, which doesn't seem like a big burden at interest rates of 2 or 3%, but is a huge burden on our children or grandchildren at interest rates of 10 or 15 or 20%. And that would be catastrophic. It would require huge tax increases, very large cuts in spending, and interest rates would be really, really high. And all of those things could push our economy into a tailspin that it wouldn't recover from for a generation. And because the United States is the ultimate too-big-to-fail entity, it would bring the world economy to its knees as well. So that's why I think dealing with the budget sooner rather than later is a really good idea.
Well, we'll have to leave it on that happy note. That was Len Berman. Len, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks, Grant.
You've been listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.